Welcome to the Healthcare IT Today interview series. We feel lucky to be able to talk to so many smart, passionate, and knowledgeable people in healthcare. Now, we're taking our favorite interviews and sharing them with you. So sit back, relax, and enjoy perspectives on the world of health IT.
Hey everyone, I'm John Lynn, the founder and chief editor at Healthcare IT Today. We're excited to bring you another in our series of interviews with top leaders in health IT. And our guest today is Dr. Craig Joseph. He's chief medical officer at Nordic. Welcome, Craig.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, excited to be here. Us coming together is pretty cool because I've seen you online for years and years. And then we realized we're neighbors in Vegas. So we finally connected and heard about your book, and we're excited to talk about that today.
Yeah, I was shocked to learn that actual people live in Las Vegas, as do I now. And it was great to meet in real life.
I'm just grateful you called me a person. A lot of people think I'm a robot. So that,
I mean,
the amount of content we put out.
I watched you eat food. I did watch you eat food. So I feel like you are not a robot.
I like it. Well, before we dive into your book, tell us a little bit about yourself and Nordic.
Sure. So I'm a primary care pediatrician. I did primary care peds for about 9 years before moving to the dark side and working for a large electronic health record vendor who shall not be named, but is located in Madison, Wisconsin. So a lot of people could probably figure out who that was. Okay, it was Epic. Since leaving Epic, I've been on the provider side and the consulting side. I currently work for Nordic Consulting, as you mentioned. We're based in Madison. We started off as actually just doing Epic staff augmentation, but really expanded since then. So we focus on healthcare and do pretty much everything in healthcare. So we do major electronic health record work like Epic and Oracle Health and Meditech, but we'll also do ERP like Infor and Workday and all that kind of fun stuff, and located not just in the US, but in Canada and Europe and coming soon to the Middle East. So lots of fun stuff happening.
That's awesome. Well, they're lucky to have you. And I see why you moved to Vegas, because, you know, Madison versus Vegas, especially in winter, makes sense. Well, you just published a book called Designing for Health, The Human-Centered Approach. Talk to us about what the genesis and goal for your book is. That, you know, I know you wrote it with Jerome Pagani. Tell us about that. What was the genesis and what's the goal for this book, Designing for Health?
Sure. So yeah, Dr. Pagani, he's the PhD. I always say he's the smart one and I'm the good looking one. in our work kind of traveling around the country, we saw that healthcare facilities, hospitals, healthcare systems, doctor's offices often were repeating the same problems over and over again. And a lot of those were based on design, simple design principles that were that folks weren't aware of, or if they were aware of, just weren't kind of paying very much attention to, and really became a stumbling block for them in their projects. And often these were IT projects or operational projects, but either way, they often didn't achieve their stated goals, and no one could understand why. And when you look back maybe at the higher, 30,000 foot view of that project, it comes down to, well, the technology was fine, or the workflows and Visios were fine, but the design of some of the features was not fine.
And it's interesting you say that. You know, when I looked at the book, I was like, okay, yeah, we need to design healthcare better. I think we all appreciate that if we've ever been a patient, which most of us have, right?
Yeah.
But can we really change the design of healthcare such that patients want to engage in care? Because I don't know anyone that's like, ooh, I can't wait to see my doctor.
It's great.
It's not like binging Netflix, right?
Well, I don't think going to your doctor is ever going to be comparable to watching TV or a movie. But sure. And I do feel like part of healthcare, especially in the United States, is good. So oftentimes, if you find a good physician or clinician that you're dealing with, you enjoy that part. But sure, the registration and the scheduling and certainly the payment areas are suboptimal to say the least. And many people refer to the United States healthcare system with quotation marks around system, right? Because it's not really like someone sat down and designed a system. It just kind of happened. And so it's kind of like you had a house and you needed more space. So you put an addition on, and then you needed a little bit more space and you put another addition on, and And afterwards, you look at this, at this thing that you've created, and certainly you would never start off if you were to have a clean slate and create this thing this way. But you know, you made the best decision you could at the time that you that you did, and it's kind of turned into a mess. And I think that's where we are now, again, especially in the United States. Now, to answer your question, can you make it better? Yeah, yeah. Oftentimes you can. And our theory, our thesis, if you would, is that making things easy to do, kind of following some of the behavioral health ideas that we now know. We know how people think. We know how they interact with the world around them. And if you make things work like in tandem with some of these ideas, then it's a much better experience. I'm not sure. It's kind of like, you know, you go to the dentist and they poke at you with high pressure water or with very sharp tools. I don't think anyone's ever going to love going to the dentist, but we can make the process better. Same with engaging with hospitals or your doctor's office. We can, sometimes you're just not going to enjoy going for that colonoscopy. Shockingly, it's just not going to be great. But can we make everything around it a little bit better? And I think the answer is yes.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a good point. If you're getting a cancer diagnosis, like that's going to be a tragic situation. You know, like you can't really make that better, but you can make the experience better, which is what I hear you saying. I mean, why is holding people back from doing this? Is it, you know, overhead and inertia of just how they've always done it? Is it so many competing priorities? Is it burnt out people who are just like, I'm just trying to make it through the day. I can't think about it. Like, what do you think are some of the factors that prevent people from designing it in a way that is more patient focused? I think is, I guess, how I would describe it.
Sure, sure. Patient focus or user focus too, because we're, you know, we're talking about not just the patient experience, but also the doctors and the nurses, sure, and the therapists and the, you know, the billing clerks and everyone. I think the major problem is intentionality. And so, and what do I mean by that? You have to think and be intentional as you're designing, again, whether you're configuring software or building a new hospital, you know, thinking through, well, wait, what are we trying to achieve with this project? You know, oh, we're building a waiting. Okay. Well, we're talking about the design of the waiting room in the emergency department. Okay. So, you know, again, kind of taking that back. Well, why do we have a waiting room? Do we even need a waiting room in an emergency department or somewhere else? So kind of being intentional and kind of thinking through like, wait, why are we doing this? And what are our goals and how will we achieve those goals? And the second thing you need besides intentionality is a basic knowledge that these things exist, right? And so oftentimes what I'll see is some project didn't work well in the cardiology department. And we go back and look and try to figure out, well, what happened? Oh, well, we had a lot of design decisions about how we were going to use the software or this new technology. And so what we did is we talked to the users. I'm like, oh, that's exactly what you should do. Who did you talk to? Well, we talked to the chief of cardiology. Okay. Who else did you talk to? Well, no one. You know, she was very helpful and gave us all our answers. Okay. Well, you know, she's certainly one of the most important people in the department. And that makes sense that you would want to reach out and get some of her thoughts. However, because she's one of the most important people in the department, she's probably not practicing full time. So she's got other, you know, administrative and leadership type responsibilities. She probably has a lot of help that other people may not have. Right. So the VIPs, the big wigs, and especially in a hospital or healthcare system, you know, they'll have fellows and residents and scribes and assistants because that other people might not have. And so often if you're reaching out to just the leadership in a group, you may not be getting the person that's actually doing the work day in and day out. So you're not getting the best perspective and you're configuring a system for one person, which is great for them, but we've just established they've hardly ever used it. I always, I hearken back to my days when I was the CMIO of a hospital system and we ran a report, which essentially graded all of our doctors about how well they used the electronic health record. It was an automated report. So it just, sure, you know, went through looking at certain things. And the person who got the highest score was our chief of cardiovascular surgery. And we thought it was hilarious because he pretty much never touched a keyboard. And so, right, because he had people that did everything for him and he mostly just got paid to operate and, you know, see patients, but someone else wrote the progress note, someone else put in the orders for that person, and which is a great life. And we all should try to, you know, strive to achieve that. But so clearly this automated report was saying, yeah, the two times in the last 6 months that he touched the keyboard, he did a really good job touching the keyboard.
Well, I guess scribes are better than doctors. Is that the lesson there? But eventually it should just be the AI scribe doing everything, right?
I 100% agree. Yeah, I think everyone that's where will we're have going. That. I think you're, I don't know. I'm not joking. I think, yeah, 5 years from now, I don't think very many people, very many of us will be doing keyboard entry. Because I think, yeah, we'll have those microphones kind of, everywhere and recording what's going on and then using an AI to create the progress note or to queue up the orders for us to sign. Yeah, it's going to be a lot better, I think.
The most human-centered design product healthcare seen in a long time. Where could a person start kind of leveraging this human-centered design idea? I think intentionality is a great one. Any other suggestions on, you know, where can they start to kind of shift? Is it a shift of mindset or is it a shift of culture? What is it?
It's all of those. So certainly the mindset of, hey, we're not going to create this thing or modify this tool based on just how I want to use it. You know, I mean, that's actually step number one. It's just that, hey, I might not be the typical user. I might like everything, you know, to be very bold and out there kind of colors. And that's not typically how most people want to see their software. So, you know, again, just kind of being just understanding that you really do need to get a represent. You need to find out who your users are, what they're trying to do, what the goals that you're all overall trying to achieve. I think that's one thing. A second thing that we do see more and more commonly now is an attempt for us to try to get leaders to get out of their own way. And what I mean by that is oftentimes there are people who do have kind of formal design backgrounds or human factor engineering backgrounds. And they're not, I've seen where, you know, these are experts who know a ton more than I do about design. And I say, well, how were you involved in this project that didn't go very well? Oh, I wasn't. Or, you know, I made a bunch of recommendations, but they were overruled by that cardiology department head. I keep throwing her under the bus and I apologize to all the cardiology department heads, but
it was probably ortho, not cardio.
Yeah. I need this. Yeah. You know, as I get older, I need the ortho people on my side. So I'm going to go after the cardiologist. but yeah, like, so, you know, sometimes, you know, talking to senior leaders and they don't even realize that they have folks who have this training, who know what to do. And they're either not involved or they're overruled or, you know, somehow sidetracked so that they're not able to kind of give that feedback. And so, you know, sometimes the recommendation is, hey, you've got the people, why don't you just get out of their way and let them do their job? And even if that system is getting designed or that, that building is being, architected in a way that doesn't work 100% the way you want it to, it's probably going to be better off for everyone. And then also another take-home message is you're probably wrong in terms of what you think you want, right? Like,
interesting.
I'm guilty of that.
It's okay to be wrong. Maybe it's the message.
Well, you know, I always think about my iPhone. You know, I get an app that I like and it's working great for me. And then I wake up and it's been automatically updated against my will. And I think it's horrible and I can't believe that they changed this thing and I hate it and I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm forced to use it. So I kind of figure out how do I get my job done with this new thing? And then 2 weeks later, I have no idea how it used to work because my muscle memory has been regained. Right. And if you came to me and said, hey, Craig, well, we're happy to go back to the old way. Would you like to go back to the old way? Because you were complaining a lot 2 weeks ago, almost always I'd be like, yeah, I don't even know what you're talking about. Because I got used to it in a short amount of time. So I feel like sometimes, like, even if you don't get your way initially, after you get used to it, you're like, yeah, this is probably better.
That's really interesting. I was having this conversation with a patient recently. It's like, yeah, we need to listen to patients, but it's true whether you're listening to patients or doctors, not all patients or doctors are created equal when it comes to feedback for how a system should work. Yep. Some are better at abstracting for the community and the population as a whole than others. I mean, I remember a doctor that had advised this startup company on how to build this communication system. And then he ended up not even using it himself, but that's kind of a side story. But it's like, he didn't know how to, he only knew what he needed. He didn't know what everyone else needed, which is, I think, what you're saying to some degree as well, right? And I've seen this firsthand, you know, getting the right people who know how to abstract something for the population, it's harder than, you know, it's easy to say, it's harder to do, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. So certainly finding those kind of representative, I was going to say average, but representative users is one thing of, or folks being affected, whether again, patients or doctors or whoever we're talking about. But another, sometimes you don't need to ask questions. Actually, sometimes it's harmful to ask questions. It's much better to observe, right?
Yeah.
Henry Ford, when he, you know, he said, if I asked people what kind of car they'd want, they just tell me how many horses that they need. You know, you couldn't really comprehend the question, because he had a vision. And so sometimes it's much more helpful instead of saying, hey, what do you want? Hey, let me watch what you're doing, and then I'll give you what you need. And so, you know, I've certainly had doctors say, hey, I need this. I need you to build me an order set, you know, in the electronic health record. And you know, in the past I might've said, okay, let's do that. And if you can explain to me what you need in there. But now, my new attitude that I adopted several years ago is, hey, why don't you just tell me what problem you're trying to solve? Cause you've just come to me with a solution in hand. But that may not be, that might be the solution to your problem, but I don't really understand what your problem is. And when they tell me their problem, half the time I'm like, you know, there's another tool. There's another option. Yeah. There's something that's actually going to solve this problem much faster than an order set. You didn't ask me for that because you didn't know it existed. And so, you know, from a design perspective, often it's much more helpful to kind of watch the process. You know, where are we starting? Where do we want to end up? How do we get there? You know, instead of recreating those 18 steps that we have on paper, maybe we only need three, right? And so having someone tell me about the different the 18 different steps, that's great. I'm interested in hearing that. But ultimately, if I can get it down to being something much smaller, I don't want to replicate the current process. I want to understand what you need, eliminate some extraneous things that maybe you needed 10 years ago, but doesn't make any sense now. And then move to a much more slim, kind of slim down approach. So it's a combination of all of those things. You got to listen to what folks think they need, but sometimes what they think they need is not really it's what they want, and you know, we want to give them what they need.
What a great change in mindset. What do you need versus what, you know, what problem are you trying to solve? Changes sure. The mindset. It reminds me of RTLS, you know, that originally was like, where is the equipment, where is the supplies, right? And they've changed the mindset from, we're not, RTLS isn't finding supplies. RTLS is tracking the supplies. So I make sure the supply is where it needs to be when it needs to be there.
Exactly.
Which is exactly, you know, like the problem was, I need the, you know, I need the supply. It's not, I need to find where the supply is.
Right. So it's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. It's taking you kind of to that next step. And it's hard for us, for humans to often get past that. You know, well, I've been doing it this way for 20 years. Okay. But that doesn't mean it's the best way. It might've been the best way 20 years ago when you developed it, but now either the needs have changed or the technology has changed or the regulations have changed. And you got to take all of that into consideration.
So many examples of that. Well, in your book, you talk about something, you know, one of the themes, I guess, I think there's a whole chapter on it, getting rid of stupid stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that idea. What are some examples of like getting rid of stupid stuff?
Sure. Well, that chapter headline title comes from the title of a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine called Gross, right? Getting rid of stupid stuff.
Okay, nice.
And in fact, one of our internal reviewers for the book was like, I don't think you can say stupid. Like, I don't think you can tell people that some of their stuff is stupid. And I'm like, totally agree. I didn't do it. I'm stealing this from this from this New England Journal of Medicine article. And I'll give you an example that they found. So this was the chief medical information officer for a Hawaii Pacific Health hospital in Hawaii, obviously. And she said, we're just going to ask everyone in the hospital, what stupid things are they encountering in our electronic health record? In the main technology that doctors and nurses use all the time, right? And they got back lots of suggestions of stupid things that could be eliminated. And one of them was this kind of process whereby nurses were being asked to document the status of the patient's belly button or umbilical stump. Now, that seems weird, but it makes a lot of sense for a newborn, right? Because sometimes the belly button doesn't, it's supposed to kind of dry up and fall off, but sometimes it's oozy, sometimes it gets a little infected. So, you know, for a 2-day-old or a 7-day-old or maybe even a 14-day-old, that's a great question. Well, the EHR was somehow configured accidentally to be asking this question up to like age 6 months. Right. So it's like a 2-month-old and a 4-month-old and a 6-month-old. Same thing, kind of asking if they smoke cigarettes. You know, I don't think it's a very valid question to ask if a 2-year-old smoked cigarettes. Now it is a question to ask if they're around people smoking, but that wasn't the question. The question was, do they smoke? And
yeah, it's like the last pap smear for a man, right?
Doesn't correct.
Quite work.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, that would be that's an excellent example of stupid stuff. And so the key thing though, was like, no one had gotten rid of this required documentation point, for years. Right. And why? Well, I mean, it's not the end of the world. It's just a click and it's just, you know, it takes a half a second but there's thousands of these things and they kind of kill your morale. Cause it looks like whoever configured this electronic health record or developed it doesn't really understand medicine. Right. And so if I lose confidence in the person that's designing the main tool that I use, it's a bad thing. So what they did, not unusual. Lots of us actually run projects where we ask people for examples of problems. What they actually finished the job, which most of us don't, right? They fixed the problems, or they leverage transparency, another important design principle. They either fixed the problem and said thank you, or came back to the user, the person who submitted the problem report, and said, you know, hey, actually this does make sense. It's not stupid. And let me explain to you why, right? So maybe you didn't understand that we use this information over here or over there. It's very helpful 2 years from now. Or, hey, we totally agree. We think this is not helpful. However, there's a state law or there's some federal regulation or there's some reason that we have to do it that is beyond our control. And that's, I think, where a lot of people kind of drop the ball, is that they just, this request goes into a black hole and sometimes it gets fixed, but most of the time it doesn't get fixed. But I never hear back as to why it doesn't get fixed. And so are they just ignoring me? And if you ignore me once or ignore me twice, then I can almost promise you the third time I see something, why would I take the time to submit a ticket? Because you're not going to do anything about it, right? And so they didn't fall into that trap. They actually finished it and wrote a short paper that really was critically acclaimed because it was just kind of like, well, that's common sense. And again, I think that's a lot of the stuff that's in our book. When you read it, you're like, well, that's common sense. Why would you need to tell me about that? Well, we all get busy and we sometimes ignore common sense.
Yeah. Common sense is not that common, but to your point, the challenge is real. Like, I remember a friend of mine who just implemented the EHR in their hospital, their health system. He said, John, I have 5,000 tickets that I need to go through. And he said, and here's the challenge. There's 5,000 tickets. Some of them are a quick 1-day fix.
Sure.
And some of them are a 6-month project. He's like, how do I prioritize these? Because there's a lot of stupid stuff in an implementation that happens, yeah. but does need an architect, an engineer, or some expert to fix it. So how do you deal with that, balancing that, you know, fixing some of the stupid stuff versus bigger projects versus now AI and all the shiny things that are coming in as well?
Yep. I hear this question often and my answer is always yes. Which of course is not a good answer to that question. Well, you have to do it all, But you have to kind of figure out which of these holes, you know, are you, because we talk about these big projects, which you could think of as large rocks or, you know, yeah, other big things. And then, but we also have little pebbles like you're talking about, which is just a typo and a documentation template somewhere, which is really quite an easy fix. But it's not going to, no one's dying because there's a typo in a smart text, you know, in a documentation template somewhere. So, you know, you can't ignore any of those things. You have to continually be working on the big, you know, the huge boulder type problems, which is, boy, we need this new module, or we've just hired a bunch of dentists and we don't have any functionality for dentists. And so that you have to do that. But at the same time, day in and day out, you have to be looking for kind of medium-sized and small projects and try to whack those as you can. I tell you, I've been doing this for a long time. I've gone to you know, specialists and said, hey, you know, I'm really sorry that, you know, you wanted to get that new functionality, or you got that new fancy tool that we can't connect very easily to the EHR. And we'd like to do it, but it's just not going to make it this year. And I was ready to kind of get yelled at, maybe deservedly. And often I hear back from, oh no, that's fine, I understand, but you guys really came through with these other fixes that I needed. And I'm like, oh, what did we do? Oh, you fixed the, and I swear this has happened to me multiple times. Hey, you fixed the, there were two periods after the third sentence in the second paragraph in that documentation template I use all the time. And it drives me crazy because I have to go in and fix it because I'm an anal retentive doctor, right? and this was a 2-minute fix. I'm being generous. It was probably less than 2 minutes. Those things matter to people, especially detail oriented people, which are clinical people, right? We tend to be detail oriented. And so these little things, these little pebbles that really are not a big deal for you to fix, but we're focused on the shiny AI thing or the new tool thing, which again, those are important. We have to do those, but we got to get those little pebbles because those are, people perceive those as big wins for them sometimes. And so doing them, is really important. So, you know, the answer is yes, you have to do all those things. But you have to do them all. You have to do some, you have to pick some from each category, I guess is what I'm saying. Some of the big ones, some of the medium sized ones, but don't ignore those little ones. You do that at your own peril. That's what'll kill you. That's what people are really upset about, is why can't you just fix this little thing that I see all day long? Why can't you not ask me about 2-year-olds and if they're smoking cigarettes, right? Like,
yeah,
fix it.
It's interesting because the stupid stuff, the little things that are stupid, right, and literally are stupid and easy to fix, do annoy more, right? When it's a big thing, they're like, okay, they're more understanding. That's a big project.
Yep.
That's a fascinating insight. You know, another theme in the book is making it easy to do the right thing. You even mentioned it earlier. How does a health system work towards this goal of making it easy to do the right thing?
Yeah. Well, so step number one is what you got to figure out what the right thing is, right?
So that's the hardest step.
it really is, actually. Yeah. You know, I worked for Epic for a good number of years, and I'd often hear from physicians at our customer sites, hey, you know, I don't need you coming in here and telling me how to practice medicine. Like and they're, you know, resentful. And my answer was always like, hey, it's not my job to tell you how to practice medicine. It's your job to decide how you want to practice medicine. And then it's my job to make it easy to do that thing. Right. And so you wouldn't, it would be shocking because you're trying to put an order set together for community acquired pneumonia. Well, I do it this way. Well, I do it that way. You know, like, okay, well, we can't make it work for everyone. Like, we can't make it easy by an order set to do the right thing unless you decide what the right thing is. Mm. And so actually, yeah, that is oftentimes the hardest thing, is what is the right thing? And almost never is that a technology question. Almost always that's a clinical practice question or a billing question or an operational question. Like, you all have to kind of be on the same page. Now, once you've decided what it is to, you know, that you want people to be able to do easily, then it's up to the technology folks or the architect in a building or whoever to make it easy to do that thing, acknowledging that sometimes the wrong thing, the other thing, is what you actually want to have happen. And so, you know, I'll go back to that example I gave before with community acquired pneumonia. You know, oftentimes patients are treated with antibiotics. Almost all of us, if we get pneumonia, we're going to get a pill to take. And most of the time that takes care of it. But for some time, sometimes it's a pretty nasty bug, or we have other problems and we need to go into the hospital, and that's community acquired pneumonia. Well, typically most hospitals will say, hey, this is the antibiotic, or these are the two antibiotics that we think are best for most patients with community acquired pneumonia. Why? Because they're effective and they're probably also, relatively speaking, inexpensive, right? Mm-hmm. We don't want to use this big, a huge bomb when a fly swatter is all we really need to do to get the job done. Multiple reasons to do that. Either way. So let's say antibiotic A is really what we want. We think most people will use most of the time. Well, what percentage of the time? 70, 80%. That leaves 20 or 30% of the time where that's not the right answer, actually. And so how do we make it easy to do the right thing, acknowledging that sometimes that's not the right thing is the wrong thing. Sometimes for a particular patient, you know, if they've already been on antibiotic A at home, well, we don't want to give them more of the antibiotic that's not cutting it when they come into the hospital, right? And So the answer to that question is, how do you make it easy to do the right thing? Well, we default in antibiotic A, but we include antibiotics B and C as other options in the order set, so that most of the time when you open up that order set, you're going to have the antibiotic that we think the infectious disease committee, typically at a hospital, that's what we think is the best choice. But we acknowledge that sometimes it's not, and we want to make it one click away. And when we talk about making things easy, we're often talking about one or two clicks, one or two, changes that you have to, you know, that you have to do. Sometimes that's all it takes. One extra click, people won't do it. Right? One, if we make that little thing one extra click, it won't happen half the time. Even if people were like, yeah, I guess that probably is the best choice, but I went with the defaults. And so defaulting in an order set and in any kind of tool that, you know, we want to make it easy to do the right thing. So that's how you do it. So step number one, what is the right thing? Most of the time, almost never is it exclusive. Almost never in medicine is it, well, we're always going to do that. So we have to have that off ramp and say, you know, here's B and C, here's choices B and C. Now, every now and then, 1 in 100, it's going to be option D. Okay, well, we're not going to put option D in the order set. We're going to kind of make it go to the bottom of the order set. There's a box there, and you can just type in any order, any medication you want. We're just going to have you type that bad boy in, because we can't really plan for that. Something that happens very, very infrequently. So that's what we're talking about, making it easy to do the right thing. You know, just to change, get out of healthcare for just a second. When you get a new job, and almost all of them will have a 401k, you know, for you. Yep. The difference between opting out and opting in is amazing. So most is probably the safe way. Most employers will say, hey, if you're interested in contributing to a 401k, which is in almost everyone's best interest, everyone should be doing that practically.
Yep. The math says they should. Yep.
Right. Math says you should. And plus your employer generally contributes a little based on what you contribute. Right. So it's kind of free money there. If you're interested, you take this step and you have to apply, and, you know, it's probably 10 minutes or 15 minutes of your life, and you have to just do it. That versus, hey, at our institution, we assume you want to join you want to contribute to the 401k, and we're going to assume a number, you know, whatever that number is, 5% or 10% or whatever that number is. And we're going to automatically enroll you unless you opt out. So we're going to make it so you have to do something to opt out. Well, the numbers are just ridiculous, that in terms of, it's much more likely that most of your employees are going to be contributing to 401k if you make it opt out, as opposed to opt in. And so again, what are they doing? They're following that principle, make it easy to do the right thing. They defined right thing as contributing to the 401k. You can disagree if you want to, but that's the determination that they made. And then they made it easy to do that thing. And so you can see that in healthcare in lots of different places. A hospital might think it's the right thing to pay your copay at the time of service. I get that. So they want to make that easy for you. So certainly when I register for some of my doctor's appointments, it's right there. Like, hey, we think your copay is going to be $60 today. How would you like to pay for that? Now, is there an opt out? Yes. Why? Well, I may not have the $60 right now, or as just happened to me a couple months ago, I had already maxed out my out of pocket for the year. Right. Yep. So the healthcare system was correct. For that office visit, it would have been a $60 copay, but since I've already maxed out my out of pocket, which they didn't know, I didn't owe it to them. So that's why it's not a hard stop, right? There's got to be a way for me to continue that registration and not pay the $60 copay. But again, make it easy to do the right thing and slightly more difficult to do the wrong thing, but not impossible.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, they needed better data in that copay example, but you know, it's also interesting that some of what you described is about the education again, you know, and educating them why that is the default and why there is a secondary choice there and why that fifth choice isn't available to them, you know, and, you know, again, it goes to communication and education as well, which is fascinating. You know, obviously there's communication's a problem in so many aspects of life and work, but,
yeah,
very interesting.
Yeah. Answering the why is often makes a big difference. People are much more understanding. It's one thing to say, you know, you're at the airport and my flight's delayed. Okay, I'm going to be irritated under any circumstance. But then when you tell me we found a safety issue on your plane and we want to resolve it. I
was literally sitting on the tarmac yesterday and was like, why hasn't the pilot come on and said that Vegas won't let us take off yet?
Right.
I assumed that's probably why we were sitting there, or, you know, hey, we're getting the, you know, the spray down because it was the snow, right? Like, like if they would have just communicated the why we're sitting there for 30 minutes, I would have enjoyed it much more.
Right.
But yeah, that's
fine. Or more likely hated it much less. Right. Like,
yeah, that's,
you know, you're still not happy. I'm not happy there's a delay, but when you tell me like, hey, we want to make sure that wheel doesn't come off when we land, I'm like, you need to do that. So I will sit here a little bit more patiently than I would have prior to hearing that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, what would you tell a CIO or maybe another health IT leader is a good first step for embracing these principles in this book? Is it, you know, what would you, you know, kind of final thoughts for them? You know, obviously read it. Maybe that's the first one. Go buy it, you know. what would you say is good for, you know, embracing this, you know, kind of design thinking, I think, is what people call it these days.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, again, I think step number one is just acknowledging that there are these things, these design principles, these ways that, you know, humans kind of interact with their environment. So acknowledging that, and then intentionally applying some of these very basic principles. And again, I keep saying very basic, like I do not have any formal training in design. I'm not a designer. I don't have a master's degree or anything like that. But just kind of embracing some of these basic principles intentionally, I think at the beginning of projects or optimizations or whatever you're doing is a good thing. And then finally, identifying the folks that report to you or at the hospital who are really smart about design, either have formal training or have, you know, some more advanced understanding, and making sure they're involved at the very beginning. Because oftentimes they'll save you a ton of time and money by saying, you know, you bought this, we're about to buy this new software, but I don't really think it's going to solve the problem. I know that they want you to do it, but I don't think it's going to solve the problem. All right. And here's another way we might be able to solve the problem that no one's really thought of before. And so, you know, getting those folks, if you have them, which almost all the big hospital systems have them somewhere. If you have those folks, get them involved, give them a voice, and let them at least pitch ideas to leadership to see if, you know, if there's a better way. I think if you do those things, you're way ahead of the game.
It's interesting because if you don't involve them early, it makes everyone's life harder. Because if you're the person that is the designer and you come into the meeting and see a half-baked design, sometimes they say, you know, as someone who loves to optimize everything, that's what I like. Like sometimes you're like, it's not worth my effort.
Right. And they're right.
Far gone. Like,
I mean, yeah, sometimes they're right. And, you know, that's one of the things I just said is like, make sure to give them voice. Right. Yeah. And so they have to be involved early, but also they have to have a seat at the table. Again, I'm not looking for them to overrule the CEO. I don't think that's realistic.
They need to be collaborative for sure.
Right. But at least to make a pitch. Hey, hear me out. This is why I think that we're going down the wrong path, or this is why I think we should do it this way. And then, you know, leadership makes decisions, and sometimes they're with the designer, and sometimes there are other things that are more important, and you get that. That's why we have leadership structures. But sure. Yeah, if they're not there to hear the pitch, then it, you know, what's the point of having those folks involved?
Definitely. Well, Craig, this was a lot of fun. I think everyone needs to go check out your book. You can search for it, Designing for Health, The Human-Centered Approach. We'll add a link for it in the article and in the show notes. So appreciate you so much, Craig, for hopping on and sharing these insights and perspectives. And thanks, everyone, for watching and listening. If you want to find more great healthcare IT content like this, be sure to check it out at healthcareittoday.com or search for Healthcare IT Today on your favorite podcasting applications. Thanks, Craig.
My pleasure.